The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by Increment Vice, another One Heat Minute production that has just completed its lengthy deep dive of Paul Thomas Anderson's masterpiece from 2014, Inherent Vice. Hosted by our incredibly talented Travis Woods, narrated by Kat Corbett, and produced by myself, all 45 episodes roll through this sprawling turning point in American identity, through Doc's hazy, daisy view of the 60s, now into the harsh 70s. If 2020 was a year of something, it is the year of the Golden Fang. You have to listen to this show, an incredible series of guests. It kicked off on November 1st last year in 2019 and ran all the way up to October 31st in 2020. Really proud of the show. Really proud of Travis. Really proud of all of our incredible guests. If you haven't visited it yet, go and visit. If you have listened, go and listen again. Subscribe, rate, review. It's all part of this feed. And if you jump on and listen on Spotify, you can find playlists with the entire show all in its own little compartment. But now, on to the show.
Good, good. I say recount, stop the count, count it again, okay? Then triple count it. It's over, fucko. You lost. You fucking lost. The fucking ghost of John McCain bit you right in your fat fucking ass in Arizona. Good, you fucking asshole. Your big fucking mouth came back to fuck you. Okay? The fucking... You don't want to back the governor of Michigan when there's a plot to kidnap her? Good. You fuck... Pack your fucking shit and you're gonna lose Pennsylvania. Huh? The ghost of Daryl fucking Dawkins, the Broad Street bullies, you're fucking done in Philadelphia. You're done. Pack your fucking shit. You got a bunch of fucking flunkies around you. Get your fucking stupid sons, your dumb fucking daughter, your fucking mute fucking blowjob, Jared fucking Kushner fucking son-in-law. Get the fucking tape, get the boxes, and pack your fucking shit. Pack it now. Go the fuck away. 4 years of this fucking nonsense, you fucking blowjob. Get the fucking trucks. It's time, asshole. We could count, we could recount. Let's do it 3 fucking times. We'll triple check it. It's over, asshole. You fucking lost, motherfucker. You dumb fuck you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me is an acclaimed author. Two of his novellas, Fierce Bitches and Peckerwood, are just absolutely spectacular. He also writes less frequently than he used to, but still nonetheless very insightfully and in depth on his blog, Hardboiled Wonderland. He's quite simply one of the most staggeringly well-versed cinephiles that is around. And when you ask for a favor of him at the last minute to jump in, because such is, you need an extra source because a source falls through and you need a confirmation at the last minute, he is the kind of man that will jump on the grenade for you. He is my friend, Jedediah Ayres. Jed, thank you so much for coming back to All the President's Minutes.
Oh, wait, this isn't the Heat one? Because I just watched Heat, and I've got a lot to say about it.
Well, I think everyone listening can agree, you and I talking about Heat is always fun. So if you need to get some of that out, I'm more than happy for you to start that way. But sure, we might
just slightly diverge back into 1976, just for a small part of the show to talk about the 121st minute of this great film.
Thank you so much for coming back on the show. I remember all the way back when I told you I was going to be doing this show, you said two things. You said, well, Mr. Pakula is no longer with us, so how the hell are you going to end this show, number one? And why, for a guy who's so obsessed with a movie like Heat, would this be the next film that you were so inclined to explore? And so I think now, you know, we spoke in the 33rd episode, you spoke to me on the 30th episode of One Heat Minute, and then the 33rd episode of this show also later in the Heat run. But we've been speaking a lot during this pandemic in our own little pandemic film club. And I guess, has it become any more crystal clear why I wanted to talk about this movie so much, or less apparent in all of our talks since then?
Yeah, I think I'm nailing down a little bit of some of the things that make you tick a little more, you know, outside of just crime, which is my attraction to Heat. But you know, there's a real precision filmmaking thing that you certainly respond to. So and this has got it in spades, and certainly it's a timely film, as I'm sure you've said on every episode of the show.
Absolutely. But this right now is, this is like confessions and sources, and especially the moment that we're in is like weird, sort of almost like espionage, like tradecraft. Like, I'm not going to say yes, but if I don't say no in 10 seconds, can you please confirm this for me? It's like one of the last sort of clutching at straws moments. And I feel like the last 2 minutes are some of the most beautiful, like clutching at straws moments. And we're about to, for these guys to really face their worst possible fears at this stage of the investigation, is to have gotten something wrong, or at least outwardly the reception of something that they've written to be challenged. So, so sort of like forthrightly, but now in this moment, it's like, it's just such a beautiful dalliance of like, I'm going to play all these calculating tricks to try and get people back to confirm something that they don't want to have any part in. And so, yeah, this is like real fun, you know, tropes and movie making sort of fun here. I can't get enough of something like this.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I love that the way it's mirroring what's going on right now in the States, where we got two people on a phone waiting, you know, one waiting for the other to blink, and you know, it's not so much action that is the key thing here. It's inaction.
Yes.
That everything is hinging on. And yeah, I mean, what a place to be right at this moment in the States. Just everybody waiting for inaction. Inaction being the key to everything. So
yeah, waiting for people to say all of the bluster, all of the weird red herrings and false actors, and the president, current president of the United States, like going onto Twitter talking about millions of votes being illegally acquired or flipping different people, and having all these fake testimonies, and then at the same time, every other news outlet that is reputable, the Times, the Washington Post, kind of on both sides of the political aisle, Washington Post and every paper kind of universally going, no, all of the electoral officials across all of the different states have tested any suspicious entries, have then done sample checks across their entire received vote. And now, like, we are literally Dustin Hoffman right now in this moment, this morning that we're recording in Oz, and that afternoon in the States, waiting to see who's going to budge. Like, what happens next? Because, you know, it feels like a fait accompli. Like, Australia, you know, a whole bunch of other international allies have already congratulated the new president on his election. Like, it's all sort of the stock market has already responded, you know, kind of glowingly at the prospect of a Biden presidency. And yet Trump and all of his cronies are still dancing around. And even Fox News is calling it like fluff. Even Fox News is reporting in all of these controversial states that it's fluff. So
I don't know, Jed. It is a weird time.
It is a weird time. I think Fox is just showing that they're not ideologues so much as they are, showmen and business people who understand that they're going to make a killing if Biden gets in. Everybody who already watches them is going to watch them even harder. But they have a life outside of Trump, and they can't wait for an opposition force to be in there, I think.
Oh, the funnest thing is they're the greatest bandwagoners of all time.
Yeah.
Trump is, as an individual, one of the most antithetical conservatives of all time. Who basically blatantly abuses the entire conservative kind of like regime so far, all of which Fox had kind of hitched their wagons to previously. And then they jumped on him hard, and they will jump away from him hard, and then they will jump on the next guy or lady hard, and that is how it'll be. And if the Republicans are stupid enough to try and get Trump to run again in 2024 against a Biden-Harris, a tried and true sort of Biden-Harris 4 years in the office, undoing some of the things that he's done and hopefully getting some runs on the board, then they'll hitch their wagon to him again. It'll be it's such beautiful transparency. In the words of Miami Vice, I like businessmen who are confident because they're very predictable. We know how they're going to act. It's like, yeah, okay, cool. What's actually surprising, though, is that right now, some of them aren't going for what I think the Trump true believers and his inner circle of cronies are doing, which is they're playing the short game of trying to disrupt and make this as difficult a transition as possible. Where I think the power of Fox is like, no, there's going to be another person in, and we got to start rebuilding. We got to start talking about different things. We got to start challenging. We got to start putting the rhetoric out there that this Biden presidency isn't working, and continue to, spruik our very loyal and, insanely turnouting voters to the next candidate.
Yeah. I hope the country ages out of Fox in the next few years. somebody else will be along if Fox isn't around, Or Fox will change in some way that suits the younger demographic a little in a very scary long game. But
the big one is that everyone's been saying, and I don't know if you've read as much of this as I have, but like the pundits
are
saying,
I have not.
No, well, everyone's been saying that Trump, will then catapult himself, whether it was from a 4 year term or an 8 year term, would catapult himself into his own network. There would be like a Trump network, and he would be a figurehead of that network and use all of the people that are sort of aligned to him on that sort of level of extremity and sort of like showmanship and extremity, and have his own network out there that's constantly, being an alternative media outlet. And I think also Fox are probably pretty aware of that. Because I don't think he's just going to walk and take a seat at, Fox and Friends, even though they'd probably love him for it because their ratings would go through the roof. But I think he probably would go out on his own and do something like that anyway. So, they might be just, earmarking a potential future competitor and just go, no, we're not going to give this guy too much more profile. He's going to be a competitor before we know it. So we may as well get on with this.
Yeah. If there's any joy... anything to enjoy at this, it's watching, just knowing he's grasping it. He's got to find some way to stay viable for his creditors, to keep money coming in. So whatever it is, whatever the next move is, it's I'm just hoping it's miserable. I'm just hoping
well, on that beautiful note of Trump's misery, let's dive into Alan J. Pakula and Robert Redford's 1976 masterpiece, All the President's Men. It is the 121st minute. Jed and I are going to watch it together right now. You guys are going to listen along, and we're going to come back and talk about it. It's a really dynamic scene. It's criminal sometimes that these minutes do this, because they put us right in media res of like another scene that's already happening. But this is what it is. So let's watch Dustin Hoffman listen intently on a phone call, and then start freaking out and running through a newsroom together.
9, 10.
You got it straight, man? Everything okay?
Everything's fine. I said if I get to 10 and you don't hang up, it's solid.
Did he confirm it?
Absolutely.
You gotta tell Brad.
Bernstein got another source. The guy just is confirmed.
If there's any doubt, we can run it tomorrow.
You don't have to. The story's solid. We're sure of it. He's just got off the phone with his gold.
Okay, we go with it.
Did you just give me the climax of the movie? Did I?
One of them, definitely. One of the climaxes of the movie. This is, I think I've spoken to a few people, is this movie is 137 minutes long. So, you know, almost 2 hours and 20 minutes. Shorter than Heat. But it's almost 2 hours and 20 minutes. And for a long time, it is a glacially and very deliberately paced film about the sort of the emotional tension in conversations and the moral complexity of actually going on the record when it's probably not in your best interest to, and these guys being able to extract stories out of folk. And the last kind of 10 to 15 minutes, even 20 minutes of this movie feels to me so incredibly ferociously paced. Like you are just bang, story beat, story beat, story beat, story beat. Things are flying through. And, you know, this is, they're about to make a mistake. They're about to miss. But in this moment, it's a dynamic scene. You've got Bernstein listening. You've got this absolutely awesome exchange where they run through the newsroom. Again, one of the most, the biggest production design flexes of any film ever, because this newsroom is so outlandishly perfectly designed and the shots are so outstanding. And then one of the most glorious little match cuts of an elevator door closing and a newspaper sliding into frame. And it's just, it's a perfect little summation of a story. And these guys panicked, and Bradley's confidence in them, you know, right there in that moment is that he's sure they've got it. It's outstanding.
It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I'm thinking now that the other way that this movie is so 2020, hold on, cars passing, sorry, I'm outdoors. The other thing that makes this a great 2020 movie is the hairstyles, because I don't know about you, but nobody's getting their hair cut right now. I think history is going to look at 2020 as the year hairstyles changed.
I'm just going to show Jed. I've been keeping my hats on.
Oh, wow.
And my hair is much longer than it normally is. I've been keeping many hats on in many Zoom sessions because my hair is just getting out of control. And my wife's like, you should probably go get a haircut, because Australia at least has hairdressers open. And I'm like, look, I speak to so many folk who are still in lockdown, various stages around the world. I feel bad that I can just go and get a fresh fade. So I'm going out in sympathy with my friends internationally, growing long beards and keeping my hair pretty well grown. So that's what it is. But no, you're absolutely right. Like the style here is as good as it gets. I think the only thing that hasn't aged as well is corduroy. We can be fair that corduroy hasn't aged as well as other materials in this movie. But a wide tie and a collar and flowing, beautiful Dustin Hoffman hair, it's as good as it gets.
I'm not sure how it started. 20 years ago, more than that, I got a pair of corduroy slacks for Christmas or my birthday or something like that. I never, ever buy my own clothes, ever. I've always had hand-me-downs and gifts. But the thing is, for then years, several years after that, I just got inundated with corduroys every Christmas and every birthday.
This is a new side of you, Jed, that I think I haven't heard yet. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, everybody thought I loved corduroys because I wore corduroys. And I was like, no, I wear quarters because that's what I have, because that's what people give me. But yeah, no, I was riding the corduroy wave. I was probably the only one out there on it. But yeah, I've got a closet full of corduroy waiting for to be wearable again.
No, you've got to start.
2020 is the year, maybe.
This is what a few people have said to me on the show when I've talked about corduroy. It's now or never, Jed, because the remainder of the year is, you're not going to be going out as much. I think you got to bust out as much corduroy as possible. And in our little pandemic film club, folks listening, Jed and I are a part of a little close-knit group of friends who have a little pandemic movie club that has been keeping us sane throughout much of this crazy lockdown period, getting to catch up once a week and talk movies outside of the times that we've talked on about movies on podcasts or movie on podcasts. I think, Jed, next week you've got to bust out some of that corduroy, man. It's just, you have to. It's almost undeniable at this point.
Only psychopaths are wearing pants at all these days. I don't know. But you're, like, once we're out in public again, we'll have corduroys and all the president's men haircuts, I think.
Oh, I think, I can't wait. I'm looking forward to hopefully a new presidential group there. But let's talk about, you know, you're a person who is so familiar with different crime movies in across all different spectrum of time and countries. And I think, you know, great genre films just in general are so steeped in really terrific production design. And I think that, like, different spaces and, you know, I think some of the best we've recently talked about Chinatown a little bit, like, you know, one of the greatest movies probably ever made, but also like the best looking, like, it still endures. I think that is something where people go, well, how much was the budget on it? Or was something worth creating this whole space? Or was it worth dressing these sets every day? Was it worth having all these extras? It's for shots like this where, and shots really throughout this entire movie, where there is not a single shot in this movie that feels labored or feels like it ages out or feels like you're seeing the strings or anything rough. Like, you can't hide things in a newsroom that you need people to be able to run across effortlessly. Right. Like, they're just in a real space. And I continue to marvel at it. And it's not just the big sweeping still shots. It is actually unbelievably frenetic. I've got to dodge people. People have to move out of my way. People, I'm disrupting them as I'm running past them and yelling out and looking for people and all that sort of stuff. I just can't get enough of, like, that's, for me, is such production design porn. I just can't get enough of it in movies like this.
Yeah, no, all throughout this one has got great camera movement and great, invisible choreography to all the extras and the main actors moving like that. But also the production design and the attention to architecture and things like that. Stuff that wasn't made for the movie, the exterior shots and the,
yes.
I just watched Clute and Parallax View again. And, you know, that stuff is in there too. So it's definitely, he had a damn fine eye for, and knew it was important, because you're right. It would absolutely hold up to, you know, anything quality wise, technically, being made in a similar fashion today.
Yeah, I think that's one of the, just in general, is when you have to have it in the frame, you know, when you have to make it happen in the frame and you have to use the architecture, you have to use the space, or you have to use real machinery or whatever you're doing, I think it's so hard. I think it's so hard to even compare. Like, last year, 2019, one of the last films I saw in the theater was Apocalypse Now Final Cut. Like, they put a big 4K thing up on a repertory theater in Sydney at the Cremorne Orpheum, and two of the sort of ride or die One Heat Minute crew members, Garth Franklin and Stu Coote, and I went along to see it together. And the moment that they arrive at the village that is, you know, the Rise of Valkyrie scene, it's not just like the actual Rise of Valkyrie scene, but when they're down stomping through that village and there's like five helicopters in the shot and there's extras doing things and there's Coppola making a cameo as a film director and there's just so much chaos, special effects can never live up to that level of production insanity. Like, it just can't live up to it. Obviously, this is a much smaller scale thing, but I think that when you look at those things, and even, you know, even like the Ben Hur's of the world and things like that, where there are actually people and there are actually crowds and there are actually, you know, crazy designed things to replicate Rome. You know, when you go back and look at Gladiator, they're the things that age out the hardest. You know, you're like, oh, the special effects look good. But as soon as you look at it on a high def Blu-ray, you're like, ugh, someone needs to fix this. But that doesn't happen with All the President's Men. And it doesn't happen with things like Apocalypse Now. It just doesn't happen. Like, they look phenomenal for a reason.
That looks great. And I think it's amazing that somebody like Coppola, when you bring him up and Apocalypse Now, when he did just the opposite, when he really made a decision that, you know, to film everything on sound stages for something like Dracula, and it's a huge, lavish production, that there is a real purpose to it too, you know, that even though it looks great in the way that it doesn't look real, you know, it looks surreal. And it's so, you know, again, he's certainly, there's a lot of special effects in Dracula, but it has a totally different feel. And it's intentional and it works, and he knew when it worked. And of course, now maybe it's just that he doesn't have budgets that he used to. But
when you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
But yeah, I wonder what Pecula would have evolved. It's interesting watching a lot of movies by, you know, kind of masters of the past as they're dealing with new technology and they're playing around with it. And some of them are doing interesting things with it and clearly having fun playing, and others are just kind of cranking stuff out. That
you said that you watched Clute and Parallax again in preparation, as you do. And did Fonda win the best Oscar, best actress for Clute?
So I didn't think she had. I don't follow the Oscars. I don't know who's been nominated, but I looked it up, and I, you know, something, I think it was IMDb, said she'd won. So I'd be happy to keep that illusion if it's not true.
Well, that's good.
She's amazing in it.
That whole movie is so terrific, and it is a performance movie, so it hinges on her complexity and everything that's going on. It's you know, completely sublime. There's no doubt there. But
yeah, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
Please go.
I was going to say something that stood out to me thinking about Zodiac coming up is the and that there's someone on the roof scene in Clute. Is Fincher clearly took from that for the there's someone else in the house basement scene in Zodiac. I mean, that was just, I just made a chef's kiss, if you can't see.
Yeah, this is the thing that, you know, Pakula just seems to be the kind of guy who, he's a beautiful, he's sort of inspirational, but he's like a beautiful inversion of like a Fincher, or a Michael Mann, in that those characters are so fastidiously obsessive about the vision that they see in their head. And there's certain things that they have to surrender to their collaborators. And then other things like just the performances or how it flows in the frame and what they can actually control as a director. They seem to go, okay, I'm going to make a choice. I'm going to push this to the nth degree because it's in my power to push it to this level. Whereas Pakula seems to be the kind of guy who is much more meditative in there and like gets in there and he knows exactly what he wants, but he kind of is the guy who is like a great, you know, coach, whether it's, you know, of any team sport, in that there is so many great people around him in this movie. Obviously Redford is a terrific producer in his own right, a phenomenal actor. Hoffman's great. You know, got a script by William Goldman. He's got Gordy Willis lensing the entire film, and then the best production and Academy Award designers, you know, all there too. And then Robert L. Wolf, who's a Peckinpah alumni, as the editor, and just trusting that collaboration and just sitting in there and going like, if we've prepared right, this will all, you know, sort of be beautifully executed. And how he's in there and just engages with the actors and loves getting them in there to do it. He's a guy who's like formal quality and all that sort of is incredible, but he just doesn't seem to have the bluster of those guys. You know, he's not doing 1,000 takes. He's not doing 1,000 takes and people are writing hot takes about his 1,000 takes. He's doing exactly what he needs in that moment and kind of getting really phenomenal performances out of people.
You don't think he was really pushing Brad Pitt's Irish accent? And you don't think he was, come on,
he had it cranked to 11. He's like, Brad, go ham. I just want you to go
harder.
Harder. Lean in. If you thought Richard Gere's accent was bad in The Jackal, Brad, go harder. Go harder, my friend. You know what's so funny? And no one references this in with The Devil's Own is Devil's Own. Good movie, bad accents, and distractingly bad. But like a couple of years later, Brad Pitt goes and does a pikey. You know, sorry if that's an offensive term, but he does a pikey for Guy Ritchie and it's insanely great. Like it's phenomenal. And so I wonder if a really colossally bad bad reception of his Irish accent in The Devil's Own at least inspired him to look, no, I'm going to have it one more crack. I need one more crack at this. And he got it.
Getting back to Clute, Jane Fonda's got a scene where she's doing a brogue in an audition.
Yes.
And it's bad. And I mean, yes. Jane Fonda's performance is fantastic. Because she's an actress playing an actress, and she's doing a bad audition convincingly.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, I wonder if it's just Bakula's his version of a brogue. Maybe the issue is his.
Yeah, you're like, Alan, you're so good at everything else, you cannot hear an accent to save your life. You know, the accents are bad across the board.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really get a shot at doing too many other films with accents. I'm just trying to actually look up Pakula's resume while we're talking to be like, did he ever have a crack at like many international things besides The Devil's Own?
Sophie's Choice.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't seen several of his films, but
it's a crazy, you know, there's The Devil's Own, The Devil's Own hasn't been getting much love, but The Pelican Brief has been had love heaped upon it every part of this show. And I've been trying to get more people on to Comes a Horseman as well. Speaking of Fonda, who does a terrific performance in Comes a Horseman, as does James Caan.
Man,
Robots.
Jason Robards.
Yeah. Right. He's great in it. It's a very proto Yellowstone kind of thing going on there. When we're watching this scene, you get a little flash of Robards as Bradley, and this is probably the most heightened and pumped up we've seen both of these guys, and panicked and out of breath. What are your thoughts on both Redford and Hoffman as performers, Jed? Because I don't think we've talked too much about these guys. Maybe we've talked about them in reference to, you know, similarly Hoffman, particularly coming out of the actor's school and method and things like that. Are these guys your guys? Do you like your Redfords? Do you like your Hoffmans?
You know, it's funny because they're both they're kind of examples of opposite trajectories that way.
Yes.
You know, Redford kind of plays He's the movie star, who's a good movie star, but he's, you know, kind of the same role to role. And I think that there's, I think my mom pointed it out to me when I was a kid. She was like, look at his directing choices and he's casting, you know, like, geez, River Runs Through It. Did Brad Pitt look just like young Robert Redford?
Yeah.
And that, and, you know, she was saying, he seems to be very taking on his own persona in his directing choices. And that probably, probably some truth to that, but, yeah, he does that same kind of thing, role to role, where Hoffman kind of goes big and, you know, gets wild a lot. And certainly that makes for some splashy good times and some cringy events too. But
yeah, Hoffman's a guy who is constantly in the method way, like improvisational and willing to go off book and sort of will rehearse and try and tailor you know, script choices and things like that all the way down. I've heard a little bit of more inside information, which people are going to hear, and I'm not going to spoil where they're going to hear it from in one of the upcoming episodes, but I've heard that Bakula did like to rehearse with the script and then improvise during those rehearsals. And then occasionally, if there was a tweak or a line change, lock the script from the rehearsal improvisation. So not actually on the set. And I have heard that obviously Hoffman is a guy who still continues to go off book on set as well, but it was just an interesting insight for me that, like, this is a guy like Lumet who, like, loves the improv in, and even Coppola, like, loves improv in a rehearsal setting, and then we'll tweak things and adjust it so that, like, on the day you're going to get it. And then for very special actors like your Brandos and stuff like that, things will continue to evolve and change. But that's style as well of, like, loving the rehearsal time, especially, and then playing to the strengths of the actors.
I don't know what most of those words meant, but yeah.
You know
what? I didn't go to film school. No, I mean, like, I just have to sit down and really concentrate on all
no,
that.
No. Meaning like, Jed, if you've written a script, there's always this thing, and I guess it's like, since Judd Apatow came out and you sort of showed warts and all of the ways that he gets his guys to just improv in the scene, on the set, during the setup, like just run line after run line after run line. There's always this big thought that improvisational actors like De Niro's and like Pacino's and like, you know, Hoffman's, for example, that they just improv during the scene on the set. But actually, there's a whole school of thought, like time where there would be more rehearsals where they would actually improvisational, like, you know, improv a line in the rehearsal, and then the writer, the screenwriter or the director would just change the line in the script so that on the day, that's the better line, or that's the better way to read the line, or, you know, someone says half a sentence here and the other person says it there. And yet still, you know, like Heat, one of my favorite facts about Heat is that, you know, Pacino would do like six takes, and have you know, great options for Michael Mann to choose from, and Michael would have everything that he'd want. And then he would look over at Michael Mann and go, cool, you got everything you need. Cool. Let's do some wild ones. And then he would just go off. So right then he would do all crazy line readings or improv or change things or whatever, but he would make sure that in those six first takes that they had it, you know, that they had exactly what they needed.
Yeah. It's interesting because, I mean, I wouldn't have known that about Hoffman. I don't read about actors and their approaches or anything, but I mean, if he's somebody who's been in a lot of very writerly, you know, a couple of Mammoth productions,
yes,
you know, like American Buffalo or Wag the Dog or the Mammoth, the fake Mammoth Confidence. these are all, I mean, they're very, very precise,
yes,
precise with the words, and certainly you can say them different ways, but I would imagine that there's not much improvising going on in those situations. But you get into something like Hook or Dick Tracy or Tootsie, or, you know, I mean, probably where you're going big, going for laughs, and certainly some spontaneity is
yeah,
called for.
I think like some of them, you know, even like Ratso in Midnight Cowboy, you know, just that once you've got that energy bouncing around and saying and fumbling a line, like it also almost adds to the great quality. But yeah, I agree. Like when you go further into his career, it's like, especially when it's like the I Had Huckabees and things like that, where you've got these like really overbearing directors, like you would imagine that there's not a lot of room to play. But you know, even things like Luck, which unfortunately was canceled, so terrific. But I would imagine that Michael Mann is not a guy, and nor is Milch, who is please improvise my immaculate dialogue. Like they're not, they don't seem like those guys.
Right. They didn't make Lenny.
No, they didn't. But God, he was good in Lenny. Very good.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
But there's a
I just wouldn't have had that impression of him as being somebody who's I take your word for it that he's an improviser. And I just know he does make big choices to, you know, even within the script being very locked in, he'll make performance choices that are very mannered and very peculiar to that picture, that role.
Yeah.
As opposed to Redford, who I don't notice that coming in.
I notice it way more almost in this performance than so many other performances in his career, where he's literally in particularly as Woodward, he is really doing something deliberate to distance himself, even though he's imbuing Woodward with that movie star quality. Like all of the, I don't know, just the mannered, the sort of Midwestern mannered nature that he's taking instead of the sort of wry cheek that he has in things like The Sting and then Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. Like he's doing something very different, but his talent is being a guy who, like, he reads what's on the page, he applies his charm to it. That's what, like, that's the great thing. And I think even a bit later, he gets better at playing off people's expectations of him, like, you know, Sneakers, Spy Game, he's what should have been his last movie, but he was actually some voices and did a cameo in Avengers Endgame. But like The Old Man and the Gun, like he's just so wonderful at playing into and out of that persona as well. So yeah, they've got a great energy together. It's so hard to imagine who any other two guys could have been to do this scene, these scenes, and have this energy and have this chaos happening at the same time.
I'm trying to think. That's reminding me of a thought about Redford. I'm wondering if it applies to Hoffman at all. But Woodward and Bernstein and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid are two just like all-timer buddy combos. And I wonder if there's a particular quality to Redford as an actor that makes that work. I'm trying to think of another. I mean, I suppose Midnight Cowboy maybe, but I don't know that they have quite that energy. Is there another place in Hoffman's career that you think?
I mean, one is Wag the Dog you mentioned, which I think is underrated as far as his ability to like play completely off to Robert De Niro's straight man, a deeply underrated De Niro performance, a terrific film. But I love watching those two play off one another because they're just so drastically different. But no, it's so hard. You're trying to look and I'm just trying to look through some of his older roles here. I mean, you know, the kind of, there's nothing that even comes close. I mean, Rain Man, maybe the other, like as a buddy, it is like ultimately what is a buddy movie, but Hoffman doing one level of extremity and Cruise using all that sort of charm and those sorts of things, but it requires a younger charm. Like there's, you know, he's got that sort of age on him, but yeah, it's really hard to look and go, oh yeah, here he is doing incredible buddy, you know, a buddy sort of play twofer, you know, he kind of has two of the best ever, being Midnight Cowboy and then All the Presidents. And then Redford has kind of the two of the best ever is Butch Cassidy and Sundance and then Presidents, you know, it's really hard to see anyone play off those two. And only another movie with Midnight in the title, Midnight Run, has another great buddy team, but for very different reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've never seen Rain Man. I should see that sometime, huh?
Yeah, it's very good. It's
I'll watch any kind of trash out there, but
it's very good. It's I think if Rain Man has aged any, it's that whole when you know that it's like when it wins Oscars, it sometimes retroactively fits the mold of like, oh, they were just punching for an Oscar here. That's what they were doing. Their whole intention was we're going to get an Oscar. This is how it's going to happen, yeah. and sort of did it. But nonetheless, they're very good together. And also it kind of suffers in being ripped off in a lot of different things. Even piss taken in something like The Hangover. It's got its brilliance there, but you know, he's got great performances all throughout his career. Marathon Man,
huh?
Like Marathon Man, obviously we mentioned Tootsie before.
Oh yeah.
Wag the Dog. He's so terrific.
Yeah. Straight Time
Straight Time.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Really great. Really great.
Yeah.
And almost, such a young Gary Busey, such a young Gary Busey in that movie. You're like, he hadn't quite grown into his teeth.
Right. Yeah.
It's a great little one.
No.
And Straw Dogs. Straw Dogs, Midnight Cowboy. Oh my God. Did you say his baby pictures are terrifying, Gary Busey? I haven't found them. I'm going to have to find them online.
I was just projecting. I'm guessing they are.
Yeah, I mean, look.
You're born with a full set of teeth.
You only have to look at Jake Busey to imagine he's born with full chompers. They almost look fake as they came out. Big white chompers, mm-hmm. Matt Dillon-esque chompers. Jed, thank you so much for coming onto the show again. And even though I told you it was going to be a Heat podcast, to come and talk a little bit more about Presidents. is there any of those last observations that you've seen about what makes me tick, I think, before we wrap up?
She's put me on the spot there. This, I would have had an answer for this if we'd done this last night when I was a little drunk and you asked me to do this. But
you definitely would have. You had lots of answers coming through on the DMs last night.
I would have been a very good guest.
You're a great guest. Stop it. Stop it. Mate, thank you so much for being a part of the show. Thank you for your immense support across everything that we do on One Heat Minute Productions. I'm looking forward to talking to you on upcoming episodes of Miami Nice and when we dive into our next large scale, probably, almost a year long project, which will be Zodiac Chronicle, man. Thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Just before you go, watching Clute, especially, and Parallax View, thinking about President's Men, and it struck me the opening of Clute's got that cool little silver tape recorder. It's like glinting. And then the opening of President's Men, of course, has got the typewriter with the gunshot sounding things. And I was like, damn, like Pakula makes slasher movies with recording devices as the weapons. You know, this is what comes back to bite everybody in these movies is documentation of of what you did, you know? And
every single thing that possibly can be recorded, photography, records, and all that sort of stuff is all the things that lead Warren Beatty into danger and into the overwhelming omnipresent dark force of that universe. Like it leads him on those breadcrumbs. So it's like it can be a savior, like in Presidents, but it also can like a savior on the good guys and, you know, a demise of the bad guys. But I think that's so beautiful in both Parallax and Presidents. They're kind of inverted. It's like, if you find them and you follow the breadcrumbs, they'll consume you. And then if you find them in Presidents, it's like, we're going to get these out. But I love that thought though, because I think you've just nailed what so many people don't get is he's a real master genre filmmaker. He knows what entertains people, and there's something undeniably entertaining about a slasher movie. They have an energy. They do like the space to create, like you usually slashers killers, like in Halloween particularly are, silent, and there's a lot of space for you to project that.
Right.
And this movie has all those things. So I think I think you're onto something.
Yeah. And he's, we tied them into the golden fang here. And
we've had heat references.
Come all the way around.
Just golden fang. We've got it.
Golden Fang, Parallax View, double feature, right? Yeah.
Golden Fang, Parallax
View. Inherent Vice, sorry.
Look, the movie could be called the goddamn Golden Fang at this stage. There could be a Golden Fang edition, a new naming convention.
Golden Fang Film Fest. That's what we're programming.
The Golden Fang. But hopefully you can end it on President's Man because it does have some uplifting quality. You know, I think you need some others in there. You need some Chinatown, you need some Inherent Vice, you need some Parallax View. What else is on your Golden Fang Film Festival?
Shit, I don't know. Election?
yeah, that's a great one. That's a great one. Who would have thought Reese Witherspoon would have been like Trump?
Oh my god. Yeah. I have not had the, I've thought about that movie a lot. I've only seen it once, but I've not had the nerve to watch it again recently.
Don't. Not for now. Yeah. Wait till this is all wrapped up and then you can watch it and be gleeful about the craziness and the similarities. Jed, thanks again. You're the best.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me, and I'll just let you keep your opinion about me being the best.
That was my incredible friend, Mr. Jedediah Ayres. And I think there's really no one in the whole world that would call Alan J. Pakula a kind of slasher director other than him. If you want to find him, the best place to start is Twitter, which is at Jedediah, J-E-D-I-D-I-A-H, Ayres, A-Y-R-E-S. And that will link off to Hardball Wonderland and any other stuff that he's writing or appearing on, because he's a frequent podcasting guest for everything that we're doing. Thank you, Jed, again, for being a savior and swooping in for the show. Guys, thank you so much for listening to All the President's Minutes. Again, if you want to follow us at ATPM Pod on Twitter is the best place you can find us. If you want to find me, I am One Blake Minute on both Twitter and Instagram. If you want to support the show, it's Patreon.com/OneHeatMinute or going to the donation link here. But subscribe, rating, and sharing the show is a monstrous help. We are on the downhill slope. The new ending time, exclusive, not the 22nd of November, but now the 29th of November, is locked and loaded. We have an amazing lineup of guests. The end is nigh. Catch you very soon.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.